Hello, ladies and gentlemen. The MSS crew is back, and thanking you for joining us here in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org. The day's date is Saturday, June 25th, 2016, and this is your MSS host, Luis Jr., assisting with bringing to you yet another exciting and super exhilarating internet broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. Well, folks, as promised, we are back again. So, without any further delays, I would just like to introduce the presenter for tonight's program, and he just so happens to be a real smelly kind of guy. Rotten Rick is back again, doing what he does best. Without any further delays, if everyone could just please sit back, grab your favorite drinks and snacks, and enjoy the program. Rick, the microphone is yours.
I love to listen to my radio. Gee, how it thrills me when I hear it go.
Good morning, kiddies.
That's when I think of you. When shadows fall at the close of the day, I turn on the switch and it starts into play.
Hi, and welcome aboard as we go for another hour or bit here on MSS. Tonight we're going to take a trip to China. Why? Well, you know, the last number of years, China has emerged as a major power in our world. It wasn't always that, and we're going to examine that transition. And what's this got to do with MSS? Well, it is OTR in a way, because the interview we're going to listen to took place in 1996, but more importantly, I think it's just plain good listening. And here in MSS, as you know, we don't confine ourselves strictly to OTR. We've gone further afield, and for the most part, it's met your approbation, so we're going to try it one more time again. This is Back to Rewind, part two of a two-part documentary on the Cultural Revolution. Now, most of us, probably all of us, lived through all or part of it. And going back to that time, we didn't know what was behind that big red wall. In fact, Peking was very good about managing their news. For most of us, we heard reasonably good reports from the communist blocs, filtered through propaganda, of course. Shortwave radio was one of the big vehicles for that, and back in the 60s and early 70s, I was listening fairly closely to a lot of that stuff. Where some of the countries were very sophisticated in how they presented the news and their propaganda, Peking, or I guess Beijing, depending where you want to come from, wasn't really clued in too much. So what we were hearing from behind Mao's curtain were stories like this, and this is a paraphrase of something I did remember hearing. A Chinese fishing boat of peasants was suddenly attacked by a typhoon, and being battered and buffeted, the crew were terrified and panic-stricken and despairing. The ship was about to sink. Suddenly, one of the crewmates remembered that in his uniform he had a copy of Mao's Little Red Book. So he jumped up and started to vigorously read from that book. The typhoon was immediately scared and went away. A little breeze came up, just enough to power the boat home. At the same time, thousands of fish decided to commit suicide and jumped into the boat. So the fishing boat returned just barely above waterline with enough fish, well, to probably feed a whole pile of people, all because of Chairman Mao. This was Peking's version of the news at that time. We know a lot more about the revolution now than we did then, but still, what was it like from a personal viewpoint? That's what we're going to hear now. I need not say too much about it. It's presented in a way that is self-explanatory. But as I said before, I think it's darn good listening. To the point where, as I heard it, I had to stop what I was doing and pay attention to it. Let's see if that works for you as well.
Hello, I'm Michael Enright. Welcome to Rewind, where today we have the second part of our look at China's Cultural Revolution. It was 50 years ago in 1966 that leader Mao Zedong said his revolution needed a shake-up. He invited young people to be its new leaders and infuse the country with what he called a new spirit. But for many people, the strict ideology led to displacement, imprisonment, starvation, and even death, as he called on young people to, quote, beat, smash, loot, and burn in a rebellion against authority. On this program, we feature an interview with Jan Wong, who, as a teenager, studied in China during the Cultural Revolution. Some of her stories from the time are chilling. We'll get to that in a minute, but first, a short segment from a two-hour documentary that aired on CBC radio program Concern in 1974. Vera Rosenbluth had visited China in 1973 when the Cultural Revolution was in full swing. She hears about the value of criticism, which was an important component of the Cultural Revolution.
Many people pointed out to me that in the old society in China, criticism was something that one could expect from the powerful, but not from the ordinary people. For example, an employer could criticize his employee, a man could criticize a woman, but never the other way around. And this really is one of the remarkable things about the new China, that criticism and self-criticism sessions play such an important part in all aspects of life. Everywhere we went, in factories, schools, hospitals, communes, and so on, we were told that people really are encouraged to be frank and criticize as well as praise one another.
I think self-criticism is indispensable for one to make progress. And through criticism and self-criticism, we achieve better unity on a new basis, you see. So that is our tradition.
In the last school year, we used to have that kind of meeting once every fortnight or every month. And we benefited a lot from these meetings.
The meetings of this kind are usually run like this. Well, the students will say something about the teaching and the teaching material first. Well, one of them might say that the teaching material is too difficult. They might say, oh, this teaching material is very good. The story is very moving, we have learned a lot. They might say that this sort of teaching material is not very good. It's too thin, the content is not very rich. They might say that we hope we can have something more about this subject or that subject. And then they might comment on the teaching method, too. They might say that perhaps we should put more stress on speaking and listening. We have neglected our writing and pronunciation and things like that. And the teacher then will point out the students' mistakes, shortcomings, I mean.
That was 1974. Of course, those criticism sessions were often abused and became a way to silence political enemies. It is significant that the speakers in that clip talk about teachers, since it was teachers who were in for some of the worst criticism. They were often insulted and shamed, sometimes tortured, and even killed by their students. We turn now to our feature interview with Jan Wong. In 1972, Jan Wong, who comes from Montreal, was one of the first two Westerners allowed to study in China during the Cultural Revolution. She was a committed Maoist who happily ventured into 6 years of indoctrination and hard labor. In 1988, a more politically moderate Jan Wong returned to China as the Beijing correspondent for the Globe and Mail. She followed China's transformation to a new capitalism. She was an eyewitness to the Tiananmen Square massacre. In 1996, she told her remarkable story in her book Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now. She talked to Peter Zosky on the CBC radio program Morningside.
Okay, now how did the daughter of a very successful restaurant owner in Montreal, your father made his first million before he was 40?
Yes, I didn't know that till I went back and asked him. I knew he had money. He always tried to hide it from us and tell us we were really poor, and my mother always used to wash the saran wrap twice. But I had a feeling we had money, and only now when I was writing the book, I said, come on, Dad, when did you really make money? And he told me this.
But what drove you to Maoism?
Well, I guess when you come from a comfortable background and you're a Western teenager, the first thing you do is reject it. And you think, this isn't right. There's something wrong with this world.
Yeah, we all rejected it, but rejected it.
Well, some people dropped acid and some people tie-dyed T-shirts, and I went to China. And I guess the reason I went to China is because in those days, we weren't so multicultural a society, and I was the only Well, I was one of the only two Chinese families in my high school and in my elementary school. So I had always grown up feeling really different. And people were always assuming I wasn't Canadian. So I assumed I wasn't Canadian either, even though I had been here. My family had been here for three generations.
Yeah, but not all their experience had been gloriously happy either.
No, it wasn't that I was unhappy. It was that I thought I was Chinese. And so then I felt embarrassed that I didn't know any Chinese. People would always say to me, can you say a couple of words of Chinese? Like a stupid pet trick. Can you say something in Chinese? And I could hardly, I mean, I couldn't say anything. And I felt a little bit embarrassed. And so one of the feelings I had was that I really should learn a little bit about this country that I'm supposed to be from. And that was part of the drive. And also, in the late 60s and early 70s, I was just coming of age, and I was becoming a feminist. One of the experiences of my transition from being this sort of law-abiding, sort of conservative kid was to have been picked as a freshman princess. We called it a freshette princess at Loyola College, which is now part of Concordia in Montreal. And I was so flattered. I thought, oh, this is great. And but after going through that experience of being interviewed, it wasn't like your interviews. They said, so what's your favorite color? What's your favorite flower?
I was just going to ask you that.
It's purple. So that radicalized me a bit. And just standing up there, you know, and expecting people to vote for you just based on the way you look was a horrible experience. And that made me become a feminist. And from there, I got involved in the anti-war activities. We had sit-ins in our universities, and I took part in them. And, you know, the cops came in riot gear and tried to throw us out and all that kind of stuff. So I got more and more interested. And like all teenagers, when you get interested in something, you become absolute. There's no gray. You just completely adopt it wholeheartedly. And that's what I did.
So you went to Beijing University. Which is not, I mean, you don't just write and say, I'd like to apply.
No, no, it was a complete fluke. I had transferred to McGill University for Asian Studies as part of my search to understand a bit about my heritage. And that summer I had applied for a visa with one of my classmates. She was Australian. And the Chinese embassy gave me a visa, but they didn't give her a visa. And I couldn't understand why, because we had applied together. And she was white. And it turned out that's why. Because I was considered ethnic Chinese. I was an ethnic Chinese. So I went all by myself when I was 19. I didn't speak any Chinese. Well, I spoke about 100 words from Mandarin 101 from McGill. Very badly. I spoke it very badly. And I went to China all by myself, and I tried to tour around.
Yeah, you did tour around. But how were you treated? You were treated...
I was treated kind of bizarrely. In those days, there was a racially based travel system. If you were ethnic Chinese, you had to go into one travel service. And if you were everything else, like white, black, whatever, or Japanese, you would go into another travel service. Now, the one I went into had no interpreters. I got rooms without windows and some mice. And it, to me, was a shock. I'd go into the dining room and the menu would only be in Chinese, even though this was a hotel. And I seemed to be the only overseas Chinese in sight who didn't speak Chinese. So I had a lot of mishaps and adventures trying to find my way around the city.
You just pointed something on the menu, right?
Yes, and I would get innards. I knew the word, this is so funny, I knew the word for pig. And so I thought, well, I like pork, that's safe, right? So I'd point to the word pig on the menu, not realizing that in China...
They have many parts of them.
Pig meant innards of the pig. And the word for meat meant pork, because meat, pork was the universal meat. And I didn't get it. I didn't get it for months. I ate months of innards, and I hate liver.
You're left-handed.
Yes.
You are left-handed. You're the only left-handed person in all of China, presumably.
Well, practically, because anybody who's born left-handed there gets switched. And so I stuck out all the time. And when I was a reporter, it was very awkward. And if I took notes, I would give myself
away. They'd point at you and they'd look at you.
Yeah, people would point at me. And in the canteen, when I used to eat at the Beijing University canteen, we had little tables and you had to seat eight people. It was this little square table, two on each side. Very cramped, and nobody wanted to sit with me because I was left-handed and my elbows, and they weren't used to eating next to a left-handed person.
Is there a philosophical point behind that observation? Is it, you know, make everyone the same?
Yes. Everybody should be the same and conform and you shouldn't be out of step with society. I think that was the whole idea. And and somehow left was no good. Left-handed, well, we had that too in the West. We used to make people switch over for many years, and only recently have we decided, well, it really screws up your brain.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe that explains what happened to the Cultural Revolution. All those left-handed people with screwed up brains. I mean, I don't know.
No, you were more Catholic than the Pope. You were the most avid Maoist in a world of Maoists.
Well, the problem was I...
And your faith was never shaken.
It was a bit. I had a bunch of experiences that slowly eroded that faith. The problem was that I went there and people had already stopped believing. Many people had already stopped believing by 1972. The Cultural Revolution had been on for 6 years. But no one dared say anything. It was still the extreme years, and if you revealed that you were not a true believer, then you could get into a lot of trouble. So here I am thinking I'm in the place where everybody really believes, and so I become a true believer, completely out of step with people's real thoughts. And it took me a long time to see through it, partly because I was a stupid idiot, you know, and a dumb teenager, and partly because I was a Canadian who took things at face value. I think we're kind of innocent when we go around the world.
People said you would. Now, I'm going to have to say, as we continue to talk, I may have to say some of the Chinese words and Chinese proper names that are in the book in Roman letters. Xi Guan, say that for me.
Xi Guan.
X-I Guan.
Yeah, Xi Guan.
Means get used to unpleasant things.
Right.
People said you wouldn't.
Right.
You did.
Well.
You sought them out.
I gritted my teeth and I did, but I now love to be comfortable.
But you sought out hard labor.
Yes, that was part of the whole philosophy. We used to shout slogans about being tough and living simple life. And yeah, I really thought it would be great. And one of the funny things I did, my family thought I was completely nuts because in between I came home for a year from Beijing University and I went back for my final year at McGill and I lived in the student ghetto at McGill and I had a room. I can't believe it now. After a year of having no hot water, I found a room with no hot water in Montreal. And it turned out I had to go to the swimming pool to shower every day because I couldn't survive. And once I had my sister over for dinner, and I fed her two pieces of chicken, like mouthfuls of chicken, because I had rationed myself. I imposed this ration on myself.
In Montreal?
Yes, in Montreal after I came back. I allowed myself one whole chicken a week. That was it. And my sister came for dinner, and she couldn't believe it. And she went home and told my mother, I need another meal, because my sister didn't feed me anything. So I guess I was kind of a nutcase. And I guess I was partly brainwashed, too. And I really was looking for something. When you're young and idealistic, and you want to change the world, you look for these simple answers. And having no experience with reality or pain or any suffering, you just think the solutions are so simple.
Jan Wong with CBC Radio's Peter Zosky in 1996 about her years in China during the Cultural Revolution. I'm Michael Enright, and today on Rewind we have the second hour about that 10-year period when China tried to remake itself. Let's get back to Jan Wong with Peter Zosky.
The Cultural Revolution affected language, it affected your attitude. You became a snitch.
Yes, and I have to put it in the context of I was trying so hard to do the right thing in China, and the way things were defined as being right and wrong were so different.
Yeah.
It was correct to try to save people. It was correct to criticize people who seemed to be edging towards the bourgeois life. So what happened is, after I had been in China for a year, I was getting ready to return to McGill, and I had been through a whole year of hard labor and intensive Chinese lessons and total immersion into Chinese society. I had nothing. My mother tried to send me a couple of Newsweeks, and it was turned back as counter-revolutionary material. So I had almost nothing. I had no contact with Westerners except for this one American Chinese girl named Erica, who was studying with me in a separate class because she already could speak Chinese. So I was coming towards the end of that year, and a Chinese woman, female student in the year above us asked Erica and me to go for a walk. And this was so unusual because most people shunned us, except for our roommates who were designated to accompany us. Most people had nothing to do with us. They were polite, but there was a definite barrier. So when this young woman asked us to go for a walk, we were thrilled. And we went for a walk, and she asked us about life in the West. And we thought this was really not right to ask us, because she wanted to know about the material standards of living. Did we have refrigerators? Did people have televisions? And what kind of class background did you need to go to university? And we said, don't you realize it's capitalist? And she said, yeah, I do, and I want to go. And I have to say, Erica and I were shocked, because in a whole year, no one had said this, because most people were not that stupid. Most people could take one look at Erica and me. We were completely dressed in Maoist clothes. We had our hair in braids. We were fanatics. They knew better. This student did not know better. She assumed, well, a Canadian and an American, of course they're going to help me. They're bourgeois, right? They're going to help me. And so she made the mistake, and we made the mistake. And so Erica and I talked it over. We said, what should we do? Should we tell on her? We didn't want to, but we felt we should. We should be. We should not give in to bourgeois sentimentality. We should be tough on ourselves, too, and we wanted to help her. We thought the worst that would happen to her was that she would be criticized and saved. Mao said, you know, if somebody has a problem, you criticize them and you save them. You don't send them to a labor camp. We had no idea. So we told our teachers, and I didn't know what happened to her until much later. In fact, not until I became a reporter and I asked some of my old classmates. And she was formally criticized at a school meeting, which is horrible. She must have stood at the front and been dumped on by everybody. And then she was expelled from school, which is really horrible, because in China, to get into university is such a rare privilege. And to be kicked out meant her life was ruined. And so I feel really terrible about it. And especially now that I've become a reporter, and my goal is to protect sources. When you think about what you do to a person, in all your well-meaning stupidity, you try to do something like that, you feel, well, really bad.
It's incredible to read the growing up you writing about the teenage and young you. You laugh at the folly, and you see through now what you didn't see through, and yet occasionally I get kind of mad at you. You know, then you must too, like the snitching thing and a couple of...
Yeah, I felt really... I had blocked it out, actually. And only when I was starting to write the book and preparing for it, I got out my old diaries. I had kept these sort of juvenile diaries of the time there. And I read about what I had done, and I had written my diaries in the sense that I was doing the right thing. And when I came back, it just hit me. I had forgotten, or I had blocked it out, something. I just didn't remember.
It actually took over your whole mind. You were convinced of all the stuff. You were all the slogans and all the songs.
Yeah, well, I thought I should do this.
They were truths to you.
Yes, I thought I should do this. I thought I should go out and do labor until I could hardly move, until my arms were so tired I couldn't hold chopsticks. I could only hold a spoon, because you need more dexterity to hold chopsticks. I believed all this. I really cared, and I really thought I was bourgeois, and I had to reform myself if I was going to be any use at all to the world. And so that's why I did all those crazy things. But the reason I talk about it in the book the way I do is because it's what I went through is, in a tiny, superficial way, it's what the Chinese people went through, in a much deeper way, in a much more cosmic way. And so I understand why they snitch so much. I don't condemn them the way maybe other people would who weren't in that situation. I was in that situation, and I snitched. And so many people I know in China were snitched on or snitched on others. And yet they're all people, and they all did this, and it was a system that sort of manipulated them into doing evil things without even realizing it. They did these things and they thought they were doing the right thing. Of course, later on, there was a lot of cynicism and people snitched for very bad reasons. But at the beginning, I think there was sincerity. When kids did that to their parents, they meant well. They weren't evil kids. They meant well. It was the system.
Tell me about Anders and the trouble you got into there.
All these horrible, embarrassing stories. That happened in my first year when I was suffering complete deprivation from Western things. And he was a Swedish diplomat. He was a young man, and he was only there temporarily. He was actually a historian. And one of my friends had given me his phone number. And when I was marooned in Beijing, waiting to go to Beijing University, waiting for it to start, I was very lonely, so I called him up. It was so nice to speak English to someone. Even though he had a Swedish accent, I wasn't going to be particularly fussy. And we used to go for bike rides, and he would show me the city and explain things to me. And he was only a few years older than I was. And And I guess I liked him too, you know. And but nothing happened. I mean, it's a Cultural Revolution, right? Nobody did anything at the Cultural Revolution. So I saw Anders off and on, and it was just a wonderful retreat to go to his apartment and listen to Beethoven, which was forbidden, and to be able to have Camembert, which I had no access to. It was just wonderful. But one day, Anders had to go to the American embassy, the Soviet embassy, to get a visa. And Erica and I went with him. And we hadn't seen grass. Chinese pull out all the grass under Mao's orders because they thought grass harbored mosquitoes. But, of course, the Soviets and the Chinese didn't agree on anything, including grass. So the Soviet embassy had lots of grass. So Eric and I were thrilled. We hadn't seen grass for months, and we went running around. But the guards were shocked because we looked Chinese. And this was the time of the Sino-Soviet dispute, when they were practically at war. And we didn't understand. We were so dumb. We just thought it was fun to run around the embassy. We didn't go inside. But this precipitated an international crisis, and the school was extremely annoyed with me. They said that Erica could have been captured by the Soviets, and they wouldn't not have been able to escape. So they forbade me to see Anders. Being the fanatic that I was, I thought it over, and I said, all right, I will stop seeing him. But I accepted it, because I accepted everything that they told me. And so I broke off with him.
I'm talking with Jan Wong about her book, Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now, and I guess I should move closer to the now, but having thrown in off the top of my head, they stole your panties. Ask you about that.
Well, that was really surrealistic. Erica and I were the first foreign students at Beijing University since the Cultural Revolution, and we got there even before the North Koreans, who were supposed to be China's great buddies. And I remember when the North Koreans arrived one day, there were nine of them. They looked like little robots, and they were very cold and standoffish, and they had come to China, three of them to study French, three to study English, and three to study Chinese. And the reason is that, of course, they couldn't go to any Western nations to study languages. So we had to eat lunch with them every day at the same table. Erica and I had our own cook, except for the days when we fought to eat in the student canteen. But otherwise,
They would keep wanting to treat you better than you wanted to be treated.
Yes, that was the weird thing about China. We wanted to be Chinese. They wanted to give us privileges. We knew privileges were wrong, so we fought it. It was just sort of ludicrous when you think about it now. But the North Koreans and we used to eat lunch together, but they hardly ever spoke to us. We were really considered bourgeois. And one day, you know, they were a little nuts, I think, these North Koreans, and they were the children of very high officials in North Korea. And one day I noticed my underpants were missing. I had to wash by hand in all my clothes, which was terrible, in cold water in a little enamel basin, and hang them up in the women's washroom in our dorm. And I had brought a number of really nice Western underpants with me, you know, with like elastic waistbands, as opposed to the handmade stuff that people wore there. And it disappeared. I was really heartbroken. And then my next one disappeared, so I reported it to my teacher, who I called Fu the Enforcer, because she was such a tough, hardline person. I didn't call her that to her face. And she thought, well, maybe a class enemy is sneaking into the building. And then I thought, maybe it's this Korean guy, because he was kind of making passes at us all the time, surreptitiously. And he was a little crazy, too. And then Erica lost her underpants, and I felt terribly relieved, because otherwise I thought, is it me? And then some of the Chinese students began losing theirs. And to make a very long story short, they found out it was another North Korean student who had been stealing them. And I don't know what he was doing, but they found them stuffed down a drainpipe, and he had a nervous breakdown, and they sent him back to North Korea. And the guy who was making all the passes at us has ended up in the nuclear industry in North Korea, which sort of makes me laugh every time I hear about those inspection crises.
Jan Wong on her years as a student in China while it was in the throes of Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution. It was 50 years ago that Mao launched it as a way to repurify the ideals he had first initiated some 20 years before. If you go to the Rewind website, you can see the iconic photo of Chairman Mao in Tiananmen, spattered with paint by protesters, and also of Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau with Chairman Mao in 1973, and one of Jan Wong as well. That's at cbc.ca/rewind. In this half hour, Jan Wong's faith begins to waver. She had gone to China as a student in 1972, one of the first Westerners allowed to do so. Although she was of Chinese background, she didn't speak the language. That changed as she immersed herself in not only her studies, but also the hard labor and criticisms that were expected of a committed Maoist. Wong wrote about those years in her book Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now. Let's get back to her conversation with Peter Zosky.
I want to move to about when you meet your future husband, Norman, but I got to make sure there's adequate space between the people who stole your underwear. You thought he looked Chinese when you first saw him. He was told he's an American draft dodger.
Yeah, he's an American. He's actually Jewish from New York. He's tall and thin. He has a big nose, you know. Bushy eyebrows. I don't know why I thought he was Chinese, but he was sitting huddled.
He had a hat on, didn't he?
He had a Mao hat on, pulled over his nose, and he was sitting there hunched by a radiator because he was so cold in a padded Mao suit. And I guess he had on Chinese glasses, and I didn't expect to see a foreigner there, and he spoke perfect Chinese without an accent. And so we two of us started speaking Chinese together. He knew, of course, that I wasn't. He's not as dumb as I was. And after about 10 minutes, somebody else came over, and then he spoke English, and then I got it.
Fat paycheck.
Yeah, I translated some of the names in the book into English, just so readers could remember who they were. And I figured if I'm going to do that to the Chinese, I'm going to do it to myself and to Norman.
You were bright precious.
Yeah, I was bright precious.
But how did he get to be fat paycheck?
Oh, well, fat paycheck was ironic because, of course, he almost made no money. He insisted, like I did, on rejecting all privilege. So although foreigners were automatically paid a salary 5 or 8 times what a Chinese earned, he rejected it and insisted on being paid the same crummy amounts that Chinese were. He was called Fat Paycheck because his father was already working. His father was an old lefty from New York and was already working for the Chinese news agency. And there was a campaign on to learn from a Chinese party secretary, a peasant party secretary named Fat Paycheck, blah, blah, blah. I forget. Zhao Yulu. That's right. Zhao Yulu. Yulu means fat paycheck. So Norman's father picked Fat Paycheck for him without even realizing. His father didn't speak Chinese without even realizing what it meant.
When the purge of the Gang of Four comes, what happens to you?
Well, I guess that was my real awakening. And Madame Mao was the leader of the Gang of Four. This happened 1 month after Mao's death. And I was already kind of wondering why nobody seemed all that upset by Mao's death. I had witnessed Zhou Enlai's death, the premier's death.
With the tears.
Right. And the people were really mournful. Yeah. And then I saw Mao's death. They weren't so emotional. I couldn't understand why, because I thought they worshipped him. And then a month later, his widow was arrested with her 3 radical cohorts. And I had been thinking, oh, they're going to make pretty good leaders of China. I was completely out to lunch. And I suddenly saw people change overnight. Happy. They were happy. They were genuine demonstrations. And people were talking freely. And the whole country began to open up. And I could go to people's houses all of a sudden. And I realized that I had known nothing about a country in which I had lived for several years. And I realized that China was still a mystery to me and still had many layers which I did not understand. And I felt very stupid and really conned, but it made me want to stay a bit more and find out what was the real story.
Mm-hmm. There wasn't a moment of epiphany. There wasn't any sort of single event.
There were several along the
crumbled.
Way. There were several along the way. In fact, the first one occurred on day 5 when I was a tourist and I had tried to meet an ordinary Chinese person and I'd made a date to meet this young auto mechanic who I'd bumped into the day before and I got him into a lot of trouble when my tour guide realized I was going to go rowing with him in the park and he was berated and dressed down and she asked to see his ID card, and I don't know if I got into a lot of trouble afterwards. I think she just yelled at him and humiliated him, and he left. But that was the very first sign I had that something was wrong. And from there, it took 12 years. Well, I guess it didn't take 12 years. It took about 6 more years until I figured out. But then I was so interested in China by then, and I felt I had almost a duty to try to explain what was going on and to try to expose some of the problems in China.
When you go back in 1988 as the Globe's correspondent, Just walk me down the street with you and show me how it's changed to your eye.
I arrived not even knowing how to say the name of my hotel because it didn't exist when I had
when
left.
You left, yeah.
I didn't know how to say Sheraton. I got there and...
Wouldn't Sheraton do?
No. You had to call it the Great Wall.
Okay.
You had to know. And the people looked completely different. When I had first arrived, they were all wearing mouse suits, all with very severe haircuts. And to me, I like that. It looked nice to me, to my Maoist eyes. I thought they looked beautiful. And when I arrived in 88, they were wearing colors. And their hair was permed. And there was lipstick and wedding rings. And the men had stacked heels because they all wanted to be taller. And the women were bicycling around with sunglasses on and white gloves because nobody wanted to have a tan anymore because... Contrary to the days when hard labor was considered a badge of honor, now nobody wanted to be mistaken for a dumb peasant. And the streets were full of food. There were no more lineups. You could buy anything. You could buy strawberries, which you couldn't get at all before. You could get all kinds of meat. It was no longer true that the only meat was pork. You could get fish and duck and beef. And people looked fatter and healthier, and the funniest thing was the bikes weren't all black. Before, they used to be only black, and now you could get green and red and orange and yellow bikes. So I was impressed. And of course the cars, lots and lots of cars. And I guess it seemed to me there were tons of people. Now the population had gone up tremendously, about 50% in the time I had gone. But I didn't realize when I was there in the early days that half the people were in labor camps or on farms in Beijing, and that's why it was so empty. I had no idea that most people had been sent down for re-education or hard labor.
Mm. But that prosperity, the evident prosperity, that too is a superficial observation, isn't it?
Yes, and they were getting wealthier in the cities.
In the cities, yeah.
But in the rural areas, they weren't. In some rural areas, especially the hinterland, in the interior of China, they were very, very poor. And it took me a while. It took me my first reporting trips to get out there to see the poverty. And I realized that nothing had changed in 100 years in those places in China. There was so much poverty that I visited a village far off the beaten track where I would say, how many was it? Was it one-fourth of the village was retarded? And they were retarded not because of intermarriage of close relatives, but because of the diet. For instance, the lack of iodine in their diet. They had nothing. So when women were pregnant, their babies would develop cretinism. And they would be retarded, or they'd be too short. They would have something called Cashin-Beck disease from eating grain that had been infected. And it was amazing. You'd walk around this village. It was bleak and cold and muddy. And the parents were retarded. So they would have these kids, and no one would be taking care of them. And I saw a young woman half naked lying in this frozen mud. I saw a girl laughing and eating dirt. I'd never seen anything like it. And this is at the same time that you see people in the cities driving around in Mercedes-Benzes. So as an old Maoist, and I say that with a bit of irony because I don't really believe in it, but as somebody who believed that people had a right to fundamental things in life, this was heartbreaking in a way to see how things were changing in China but also staying the same.
How easy was your access as a reporter to stories of that kind? Could you go and see the worst parts and get into the factories and things, or would they try to shield that from your eyes as well?
Well, you were always struggling against authorities there, always, never easy. A state-sponsored tour was almost useless for a reporter. I only went on one, and that was to a satellite launch because I knew I couldn't do that alone, and that I couldn't write any stories from it. It was always hard to get beneath the surface, but reporters became very good at it, and we had a very good group of foreign correspondents. Most of them spoke Chinese. I was especially lucky because I passed. I am an ethnic Chinese, so I could pass.
Well, that actually affected your abilities, even when you worked for a while, or you got a job with the incredible Fox Butterfield of the New York Times, and who you find the people will answer questions for him to you what they won't say to him, right?
Exactly. And it's funny, even with my husband in a restaurant, he speaks perfect Chinese. He would order something in a restaurant. The waitress would sort of look at me like, what did this foreigner just say? And I'd repeat exactly what he had said, probably in not as good an accent. And she'd go, oh, okay. So I guess it was kind of irritating. But no, as a reporter, and I'm sure you know this too, when you lower the barriers between you and the person you're interviewing, you get a much better interview. So when I was a banking reporter in Boston, I used to wear bow ties and suits. And the bankers, of course, didn't think I was a banker, but it made them a little more at ease with me. And in China, I would simply wear all my Chinese clothes. And even when I told them who I was, they were very relaxed. It was much easier to talk rather than if I looked completely alien to them.
Was your Chinese totally unaccented by then, as far as you know?
As far as I know, and I could call people on the telephone, they would have no idea that I wasn't Chinese. But you have to know that China is made of many provinces and many regional accents. So while they might not think I was from Beijing...
Oh, they'd think you were from Hunan.
Oh, it's better than a Hunan accent.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Jan Wong with Peter Zosky in 1996. You are listening to Rewind here on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius XM. I'm Michael Enright. Today we revisit the Cultural Revolution in China, that 10-year period when Mao Zedong tried to reshape Chinese society. Our guide is Jan Wong, previously a confirmed Maoist turned newspaper journalist. She was also a witness of the massacre in Tiananmen Square in 1989.
I want to talk about Tiananmen Square, and I want to begin, if I can, by just setting the scene a bit the way you do in the book. First of all, I mean, we've all seen it on television. It's one of the most vivid images of our time. But it's bigger than we know. It's huge. It's what do you say how many football teams could get in there or something? Every team in the National Football League could play simultaneously.
Right, plus some more. It's huge, and you walked around it, and things would be happening in one part of the square that you would have no idea about, and then you'd run over, and then something else would happen somewhere else. So on that night when the troops came in, the square was filled with people, and partly because the Chinese government, in its wisdom, had broadcast this ominous warning on the radio and the TV saying, stay at home to safeguard your lives. Well, Chinese love to gawk, and so it brought everybody out. I thought if I was running the government, of course nobody ever asked me to, I would have broadcast some James Bond movies, and then nobody would have gotten killed that night. But they broadcast this warning, and everybody came out, and of course the reporters all were out too, went to the square, and there had been that terrible soccer accident, stampede, in England just at that time, and I was really afraid I was going to get stampeded to death. It was terrifying. There were tens of thousands of people in the square. I guess it's hard to visualize in Canada how many people that is and what it's like, and a rumor would rush through the crowd, and everybody would turn in one direction and run for no reason, and I was getting really scared. I stayed there, I guess, an hour and a half interviewing people. The tanks were on fire already, which I couldn't believe. I had to keep pinching myself. Can this be happening? Can the people be torching these APCs? What's going to happen? And I thought, the worst is that they're going to shoot tear gas at us. But I got my quotes, and I went back to the Beijing Hotel, which was near the square, and where a lot of reporters had their base of operations because it had electricity and, you know, phones and stuff. And the hotel had already been barricaded. They had wired the gate shut. There were plainclothes police on the steps, frisking every reporter that tried to go back, taking away our film and cameras and our tapes and our notebooks. But, of course, I looked Chinese. And so I just sort of shuffled by them looking like, you know, I'm the cleaning lady, and got into the hotel with my notebook intact and went up to the balcony. And about 10 minutes later, the shooting started. It was dark, and I couldn't see if people were getting killed. I could hear all this gunfire, and I thought they must be getting killed because of the density of the crowds. And then I saw the pedicab drivers, these guys in undershirts with these sort of bicycles with these carts behind them racing in, and then I saw the bodies coming out, and they went back and forth all night, and then the ambulances, so I knew people were getting killed. And the bullets were flying, but I was so, in a sense, I was just as dumb and ignorant and naive as I was when I was 19 and I went to join the Cultural Revolution.
But your reportage of the events in the square because when you say those two nouns, or those two words together now, Tiananmen Square, you instantly see the guns and the... But you weren't there when they were just milling about, and we get to know what those students... They weren't all saints. They weren't... You know, they were, there was,
no.
It's an interesting... Who is the woman, the beautiful...
Chai Ling.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was sort of like a passionera. She was a very good speaker. She was beautiful. And when she talked, people really listened to her. She was a student leader from Beijing University, my alma mater. And she would get up and drive the crowd to emotional heights. And she led... I remember her leading them and taking the oath for the hunger strike. And yes, the early days were like a Woodstock to me. It was like a festival. And the kids were all hanging out in the square having a great time. A lot of them were cheating on the hunger strike. And as reporters, I don't think we all reported that they were cheating. We pretended that they were really hunger striking. And sometimes they irritated me because they became mini bureaucrats and they tried
There was this kind of authoritarianism to the
yes.
construct of the square itself.
Yes, and in a way you can't blame them because they knew no other model. And so they simply modeled themselves on their own government and they set up all their little committees and all their little passes that you had to show to get into them. They were quite irritating and they also disseminated misinformation. It was like this mini Chinese government in the center of the square. But most of the kids were really nice, naive kids who thought it was really exciting. And it reminded me of my days when I was sitting in at Loyola College in Montreal. It was really innocent. And they thought they could do something. They were having the times of their life. And all of a sudden it got really nasty. And I think nobody was expecting it.
Let me say one more time, Jan Wong's book is called Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now, and Jan is with me in our studio in Toronto. We're going to take the whole first hour of Morningside and talk, because I want to go back to that balcony. It's gut-wrenching to be up there with you, taking your notes, feeling powerful, powerless,
yeah.
Can't do anything about it, weeping and watching. It's just
I started cursing in Chinese and English,
yeah. and
then I realized I was ruining the BBC's audio tape because he was trying to get all the sound of the gunfire, so I decided I better shut up, just take notes, calm down, just become the reporter. I became the reporter. I didn't think about things. I just observed, and I took down every minute of anything that happened. I'd record it to the minute, which actually turned out to be very useful later when we were trying to reconstruct events with other reporters and military attachés and things like that. And the whole night I watched people being carried out and bodies and people on bicycles futilely throwing rocks at these tanks that would just roar by. And I guess I didn't even realize the bullets were going right past us. I'm so stupid that they were hitting our hotel. And I still sat there not thinking about things. I guess I just didn't think it was really going to be dangerous for me because I'm just a reporter, right? I'm just observing. I had no sense that I should probably take cover, too. And in a way, I was like those Chinese people down on the ground who thought, I'm not going to get killed. This is the People's Liberation Army. They're not really going to hurt us. And I guess, like them, I was still... I remember my classmates. I had a crush on one of these People's Liberation Army soldier guys. I really thought he was wonderful. And all my classmates who were from the Army were really genuinely great people. And I could not believe that this Army was going to pick up their guns and kill us. And so I sat there, too. There was a bullet that got lodged in the balcony above us, right above our heads. And I didn't even notice. It wasn't until the next day. My friend, who was from the Times of London, pointed it out to me at the time. She says she did. I don't have any recollection of that. And then after staying up the whole night, we went downstairs to the hotel dining room to try to get something to eat. I wanted to. I'm always hungry. It doesn't matter what's going on in the world. I'm hungry. And we went down to try to get something to eat because I knew I'd have to work for days. And I needed to eat. So we got to the dining room, and I discovered that lots of reporters had the same idea I had, and they had spent the whole night watching and filing stories. And they had just had a big fight with the cook because they had been pounding the tables and demanding food, and the cook had just gotten into work and seen all the dead people, and he couldn't work. He couldn't cook. And the waitress was saying he just can't cook, and the reporters were doing their prima donna, you know, tantrums. And then the cook pulled himself together and said, well, you people are getting this the word out to the world, and so I'll cook breakfast for you, at which point the reporters all started to cry. Even, you know, this husky cameraman for CNN, he was telling me this, and he started to cry. And that's the first time I started to cry. And so they brought out our eggs, and we just sat there and cried.
How many people died? How many people died in Tiananmen Square? Because you were determined to find out.
Yes, I think at the time, I wasn't sure, but I think 3,000 people died. Sorry, every time I think about this, I get upset because so many people died, and the thing is, they can't mourn them. They can't mourn the dead, and until you can mourn the dead, you can't really... you can't really heal yourself. So I feel so bad because it took me a long time to find the people who had lost loved ones because it was a life and death matter. They were arresting people, and you couldn't talk to reporters about this. It took me a long time to find them, and when I found them, they were such sad stories. And one of the sad ones, I think the saddest one, was not about a death, but about a little boy who was on the street, and he was taunting the soldiers. This is in a few days after the massacre. He was taunting them because people still hated the soldiers for what they had done. And the soldier picked up his gun and shot him. And the kid was crawling along the street, and one of the bystanders, of course, a lot of people gathered around, one of the bystanders said, "Let me take him to a hospital," and the soldier wouldn't let him. And then the bystander said, "Look, I agree completely with what the army has done. Here's my ID card. Let me take him to the hospital." So the kid was taken to the hospital and survived. I think he lost his spleen, and I forget what else happened to him. And the saddest part was that his father, in order to protect his son, turned against other people who were trying to help, who were trying to compile a list of the wounded and the dead. He turned them in. He snitched on them because he wanted to protect his son. And when I say that, the system makes people do these things, that's what I mean. His father, even though his son had been nearly killed, still wanted to protect the government, still felt it was in his son's best interest for him to support the government.
Professor Ding, am I saying that right?
Yes, you're saying that right.
She tried to...
She's a remarkable professor, a remarkable woman. Her son was one of the first killed that night. It took me a long time to find her. She was under house arrest and under surveillance. Again, because I'm Chinese, because I look Chinese, I was able to walk right past the plainclothes. They just ignore me when I walk past. I guess I look so ordinary. And I went to see her, and she was one of the bravest people in China because she was trying to compile a list of the dead. And it was hard enough for me as a reporter, as a Canadian, completely protected, right? Nothing's going to happen to me. But for her, who has already lost her son, to go and do this, she got fired from her job. Her husband got fired from his job. They both got expelled from the party because they were loyal party members until this happened. And then she didn't care anymore. And because of what she did, she started getting donations from overseas. And she felt she had enough to live on, so she started passing it around to the families. And that's how she found more and more. Because families had often lost their only breadwinner. And so she would give them this money that Chinese students overseas had donated, or human rights groups. And she had compiled a list of over 300 the last time I was able to see her. After I left China, she was arrested briefly. Every time there's something happening, they round up everybody and detain them. And then they let them go afterwards.
Do protests from elsewhere make any difference to them at all?
I think absolutely. I think it helps. It's better than nothing. It keeps them alive. I don't think anything will ever happen to her because she's semi-famous now. A lot of people have written about her. And I've written about her in the book. And Wei Jingshen, the most prominent dissident in China, would probably be dead if it weren't for international publicity about his case. He's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize again, I think, for this year. And, I think it makes a big difference.
So the gerontocracy listens?
Well, it's a factor. They get embarrassed if a leader from another country comes and mentions their name. They don't listen, but it makes a little difference. And, for instance, when they were applying for the Olympics 2000, which Sydney ultimately won. But when Beijing was hoping to win it, they let Wei Jingshan out 6 months early on his 15-year sentence in order to create goodwill.
If I lived, if I lived in your grandfather's village, would I be better off now or under Mao?
You'd be better off now, but that's because he lives in the Pearl River Delta, which is booming and the new economy. But so he, you would be much better off. But if you lived...
Whoops, wrong village, right?
Wrong village, yeah. But of course, I'm much better off thanks to his coming to Canada. I used to think when I was in the paddy field that, well, I tried really hard to reform myself, but I did have these moments when I would like throw down my shovel and think, what am I doing here? My grandfather came all the way to Canada, now I'm back in the paddy fields shoveling pig manure.
And he came to Canada at the age that you went to China.
Yes, I didn't know that until I started to write the book, and I was thinking, gee, this is so weird, and I'm sure if he was alive, he would go, what are you, nuts?
Anyway, so you're not in that village.
No, I
don't live in that village. I just live in the countryside somewhere.
Would you be better off? It really does depend what part of China we're talking about. If we're talking about, say, maybe half of China, you'd not be better off. You would not be better off. You'd be quite poor. And half of the other half of China, you'd be
better
really
off.
Rich.
Isn't all material, is it? I mean, would I have?
You'd be freer. Freer. It's not just material. You could leave the land. For the first time in Chinese history, practically, you could leave the land. It was a feudal system, and Mao continued that feudal system of tying peasants to the land. You were not free to go to the cities. And as a result of this freedom, there are now over 100 million peasants roaming around the cities looking for work. Think about it, 100 million.
I can't.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's incredible. They're all over the place.
Two questions is this hour. Draws to an end. Can I just? I just want to say something here really quickly. We haven't come close to getting to all the stuff in this book, even though it's been an hour-long interview. Two quick questions. What's happened to Erica? What do you know about her?
Erica left China and went on to get her PhD. She was so smart, and now she's working for the U.S. government as a scientist in some completely a technical field in New Mexico. And I'm not quite sure how she passed her security clearance. I didn't get to ask her that. But like me,
she
married...
We've blown her cover now, right?
Yeah, like me, she's married a nice Jewish guy. And she doesn't have any kids, but she's thinking about it, although now she's, you know, already 40-something. But I haven't seen her, you know, in all those years. But we did talk on the phone when I was trying to do research for the book.
And how are you coping with being back in Canada and covering the surfers of the East Coast and the West Coast for the Globe and Mail?
It's wonderful. You don't cope in Canada. You just enjoy it. It's just wonderful. And I guess the bottom line is, having gone to China to find myself, I realized I was Canadian. And I don't even hyphenate myself. I don't even say I'm a Chinese Canadian. I'm a Canadian. And I used to say to Chinese people in China, I'm Canadian. Look at my face. This is what a Canadian looks like. And I appreciate very much this country. And unlike the teenager that I was when I left, thinking it was all evil and bad things here, I see so much good. And as a Montrealer, I living in Toronto, I look at the Quebec problem and I think, you just don't know how lucky you are. You just don't know what you have. We're so lucky in Canada.
Jan Wong with Peter Zosky in 1996. In 1981, the Communist Party's Central Committee admitted that Mao and the party had made mistakes during the Cultural Revolution, but still described itself as glorious, tenacious, and brave. Mao Zedong's mausoleum is situated prominently at one end of Tiananmen Square. Jan Wong's latest book is called Out of the Blue. And that's all the time we have for Rewind today. I hope you enjoyed it. Please have a look through the Rewind website where you can hear this program again. You can see pictures of then Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau with Mao Zedong in 1973, as well as pictures from Tiananmen Square in Beijing. That's at cbc.ca/rewind. And send us a note. Tell us what you thought. Did you have beliefs or did you do things when you were younger? Kind of make you cringe now. Please spill the beans. Our email address is rewind@cbc.ca. That's rewind@cbc.ca. We will post some of your letters on our website. Rewind is produced by Marika Mayer, with help on the website from Barb Dickey. I'm Michael Enright. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.
So, folks, no matter how you feel about the upcoming election, no matter how bad it may appear to be, it's a long way from what these people went through. It was nice for me to hear it from a Canadian viewpoint and filled in some of the gaps that we didn't hear about for a long time. But speaking of gaps, let's fill another one. It's summertime, as most of us know, and the weather departments are telling us we could be in for a fairly warm one. Well, for some of us, we don't have air conditioning. A few of us don't want it. And the rest of us certainly remember a time when we didn't have it. What was it like to go through those nights? Maybe some of us still remember, but let's see how Bob and Peg dealt with it.
It's not nice to eavesdrop, but it's fun. So let's check in on the comedy of errors at the Baxters. On the Little Things in Life. Brought to you by Final Net Non-Aerosol Hair Mist, a sensible alternative to aerosol hairspray.
For heaven's sake, dear, will you lie still? Mm. I cannot sleep with you thrashing around in bed like this. Now forget the heat wave, will you?
Oh, please, it's so hot, it's so hot.
Why, what are you doing?
Trying to find some cold spots on the bed.
Well, there aren't any. If there are, I would like to have my own.
Listen,
thank you.
Listen.
What is
quiet.
It? What? Listen, what?
Mosquito.
Oh, hon.
I knew there was a mosquito.
Don't turn on the light, please.
Where's my
don't
flipper?
Turn on. Oh,
I'm
going to
get him. Hey, did you see him?
Say anything. I'm blinded by the light.
I'm going to get him. I'm going to get him. Now, where'd he go? Where'd he go? Usually up to the ceiling.
If you are going to tromp around on the bed, please stay on your own side. Will you?
I see him. I see him. Now, don't move. Don't move. I'm going to get him.
Will you please?
Got him. I got him.
Well, you got me, too. You have one foot on my neck.
What?
Do you mind?
Oh. Sweetheart, I'm sorry. I thought I had my foot on the back of the bed.
My neck feels like the back of a bed.
No, I didn't get him. I didn't get the mosquito. Where is he?
You know, when you proposed to me, I wish you had told me what you were like to sleep with.
Oh, no. It might have influenced your decision.
It would have, yes. It would have changed my entire life. A lovely daydream I should like to work on right now, if you will turn off the light,
here,
please.
Look at my mosquito bites. I knew he got me. Here, look. One of my toes is driving me crazy. No. My second toe.
Oh, fine.
Isn't there one here on my neck?
No, right there?
Yes,
yeah. That's a bite, yes. Well, I've got something in the medicine cabinet. I'll get it. It'll take the itching away anyway.
Two on my ankle. One on the back of my hand and two bites on the other ankle.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my gosh. Nobody could drink that much in one night, could he?
Well, your friend Joe can. Maybe the mosquitoes are lush, too. Here, let me put this on your bites. Point them out again.
Yeah.
Where is it? Oh, yes. Yeah. I don't think the mosquitoes are he, dear. I think I read somewhere that only female mosquitoes bite.
I figured. Oh, it's so hot. It is so hot. Oh. You know it was 98 in town today?
Oh, stop talking about it. Wasn't that much cooler out here? Hold out your arm.
Hey, wait a minute. I got an idea. You know what would be fun?
Turn your head. Let me get the bite in your neck.
Yeah.
What would be fun?
Well, I'll go up to the attic and get Tom's pup tent. Wouldn't that be fun? We'd be outside in the yard.
Outside?
Yeah.
In a pup tent?
Yeah.
Explain the fun part to me.
Well, outside in the yard, it'll be cool.
Outside in a pup tent, it'll be boiling.
Well, there'll be a breeze outside. We don't get in the house.
I'm not going out to sleep in the yard. Now it is 2 a.m. Turn off the light, please. Thank you. Now lie down and please forget the heat and stop talking about it now, will you?
I am not going to stay up here another minute. I'm going to the attic, find the pup tent, and I'm going outdoors.
Fine. A better idea. Why not blow up the air mattress and sleep downstairs on the porch or curl up on the couch out there? Anything.
No. I like to look up at the stars.
How can you look up at the stars if you're in a pup tent?
Well, what I meant was I'd like to be under the stars if I'm going to be outdoors. I don't know what I meant. It's so hot and... Well, maybe I'll just go lie down on the cool grass.
Well, if it's cool, wet grass, you may get pneumonia.
Huh? Oh, yeah. Oh, my golly, it's so hot. Oh, I don't know what to do.
Now, listen.
Mm-hmm.
I may love you, but at the moment, I do not care what you do. Only do something. And if you go outdoors to sleep, please do not lock yourself out in case you change your mind, which is not unlikely, and then can't get back in the house, whereupon you will stand outside and throw stones at my screen. Are you reading me? Roger and over.
I will forgive you for that unseemly outburst because of the heat, which affects people differently.
Good night. Have fun in your little pup tent, dear.
I will. I will. And you'll be sorry you're not out there with me.
Mom. Mom, Mother, wake up, please.
What is it, Debbie? What's
something is in the attic.
Oh, something. Is your father, is he still in the attic?
Why is he in the attic? All he talked about all evening was how hot everything was. The attic's got to be 150.
Yeah, just a second. Let me pull myself together. I finally fell asleep.
I woke up and heard this racket, like somebody throwing trunks around in the attic, and then there was this awful crash down the stairs.
Down the stairs? Oh, my hip. Come on, put on the hall light. Dear, are you all right? Are you all right? Good goodness sakes, darling, here, let me help you. What happened?
Who set a mouse trap in the attic?
I did. I set four of them. We have mice. Here, let me help. Debbie, will you give me a hand? Don't just stand there.
No. Just leave me alone, both of you. If you want to do something constructive, take the mouse trap off my toe.
Oh, dear, well... What do you have there? That isn't the pup tent.
I couldn't find the pup tent.
You're not going to take this big thing out and set it up, are you? It sleeps four.
Will you please take the mouse trap off my toe?
Yes, yes. What did you do? Step on the mouse trap at the head of the stairs and then fall down the stairs? You could have killed yourself, dear.
I don't understand any of this, Daddy.
Neither, Dinah. Hold still. Hold it. It's off. You want a Band-Aid on it?
No. Thank you. I just wish to be left alone. Go back to bed.
You're lucky you had the big tent. Broke your fall. You could have been killed falling down the stairs.
Yeah, I know. Now, if you will both excuse me, please.
You want some help lugging that thing outside?
No, thank you. I can manage perfectly well by myself.
I told you the other day I set mouse traps in the attic.
I do not care to discuss it.
I don't understand. Why is Daddy putting up a tent now?
He's hot. He decided to sleep outdoors.
But that big tent, why does he want to put it up now?
Now he doesn't. He's too stubborn to say he doesn't. You know your father.
Well, maybe we better go out and help him. It's pitch dark, even in the daylight. You know how mad he gets when he's trying to put up a tent.
No, dear, no. He doesn't want help. And this is one thing, Debbie, you'd best learn early about men. There's a time to help them and a time you don't help them, and this is one of those times.
Poor Daddy.
I didn't ask him to put up the tent. It was his idea. Now he's got to prove it was a good idea. Like the Oriental philosophy. Now I have to let him prove he's right, so he, as the Chinese and Japanese say, so he saves face.
Sounds silly. We're not Orientals.
Well, they do have a point. If you want a marriage to last, you'd better learn it.
Too complicated. I don't think I'd be very good at it.
Well, it takes time. There. He's put on the outside lights. Turn off the hall light.
Okay.
So he can't see us watching him.
Well, watching you two, sometimes I wonder if I ever want to get married.
Listen, your father and I understand each other very well.
Well, I'd better marry somebody just like Daddy so that I know what to do.
Well, I don't think there is anybody like him. So you'll be a lucky girl. Oh, look at him dragging that big tent across the backyard. Isn't he cute?
Cute? I think it's dumb at this hour.
Now, his big toe must be killing him, snapped in a mousetrap.
I'm going back to bed. I don't understand either of
them. Yes, go on back to bed. Oh, look at him pounding in that tent stake. He is so mad at himself. Breakfast is ready. Good morning. I brought out some coffee. Did you get some sleep, dear?
Just great. Got the best night's sleep I ever had.
Huh?
Great. You should have been out here.
Take you very long to get up the tent?
No. No trouble at all. Not a bit. And there was a nice cool breeze all night long. I thought of poor you up there in that hot bedroom.
Well, I was so tired from house cleaning yesterday, I finally slept. You certainly look refreshed. I'm afraid it's going to be another scorcher again today. You better leave the tent up. You may need it again tonight.
You know darn well I'm not going to sleep in that tent again.
You sweetie. You are so stubborn. How's your toe?
I can barely stand. You know how long it took me to put up this tent? 1 hour. 1 hour. Then one side caved in.
I know. I watched out the window to make sure one of the tent poles didn't come crashing down and bean you on the head.
Why do you let me do these things?
Do I have any choice?
No.
No?
No, I guess not. I'm just like my father.
You are?
Stubborn as a mule.
Yes. Did you get any sleep at all?
Not a wink. I'm chewed up by mosquitoes. The tree frogs croaked all night. The tent smells terrible.
Well, I know. All winter in the attic.
No sooner lay down than the skunk that lives in the stone wall came sniffing around. I thought sure I was a goner. Then the wolf from St. Bernard came into the tent.
Uh-huh.
I thought he was a bear.
Oh, honey, a bear. Oh, my poor down here. Let me help you up.
Careful, careful, my toe.
Come on, is Daddy all right?
Oh, Daddy's just fine. He got the tent up and had a great night's sleep. Now, you perk up. Debbie said last night she didn't want to get married unless she found somebody just like Daddy.
All I can say is she'd better be just like Mommy. Ah, my toe.
Oh,
hey, look, Dad. Look, it's twice the size.
Oh,
I don't think I'm ever going to get my shoe on.
Come on, darling, I'll help.
This is what aerosol hairspray sounds like. This is what Finalnet sounds like. The big difference in the way they sound is the big difference in the way they work. Finalnet is not an aerosol. It's concentrated to give you a great long-lasting hold. There are no wasteful propellants. That makes it economical, too. 8 ounces of Finalnet go as far as 24 ounces of aerosol hairspray. You get a great hold at a great price. Finalnet, the first sensible alternative to aerosol hairspray.
The Little Things in Life has been brought to you by Daytrill, the new non-aspirin pain reliever from Bristol-Myers. The Serial Network.
And as you notice, we've gone over time slightly, so we'll just wrap this up pretty quickly. We've had a good feature. We heard from the Baxters. Not much else for us to do but to waddle off down and see what happens down the road. So for me, thank you for being here, and I hope you have a good night, and a good luck, and a good listening, and a goodbye. And then maybe I'm going to be Italian after all. See you down the road.
I love to listen to my radio. Gee, how it thrills me when I hear it go. Someday you'll hear it too.
Okay, Rotten Rick. If you're done stinking up the joint, I'm going to be breaking out some of the Febreze and trying to bring this place back to life. As always, folks, it is that time again when I have to wrap things up and shut things down for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. But don't worry, we will be back again next week. You know where to find us, you know how, and you know when. If you have any questions, comments, complaints, or maybe even a request or two, please address them via email to mikeamelli@earthlink.net. That's mikeamelli@earthlink.net. We will soon be releasing the key and returning the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish, for as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. On behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, have a great night, a great weekend, and goodbye.